Thank you for joining the post-debate press briefing about the Supreme Court, hosted by the Alliance for Justice Action Campaign. The call will be moderated by Nan Aaron, President of Alliance for Justice Action Campaign. She is joined by Dean Erwin Chemerinsky of the University of California Irvine School of Law and Professor Jamal Green of Columbia Law School. Following the speakers will be an opportunity for Q&A. I'll now turn it over to Nan Aaron.
Thank you very much and welcome to everyone on the call today, and thank you for joining us. Given the importance of the Supreme Court in this election, as we heard Chris Wallace last night, the next president could appoint up to four Supreme Court justices during her or his term in office. So this is a pivotal moment for the court and therefore a pivotal moment for the country. And we were gratified to hear that the issue was raised last night as the first topic. We are so delighted to welcome our distinguished experts, Dean Erwin Chemerinsky of the UC Irvine School of Law and Professor Jamal Green of Columbia University Law School. Both are outstanding legal scholars and constitutional law experts who will bring a great deal to our conversation today. After we hear from them, we will open the call up for your questions. And there's certainly plenty to cover, given some of the startling assertions we heard in the debate last night. Dean Chemerinsky, why don't we start with you?
Thank you, and thank you so much for having me on the call. I think the important thing to start with is there are now three justices who are 78 or older. Ruth Bader Ginsburg turned 83 on March 16th. Anthony Kennedy turned 80 on August 23rd. On July 23rd, Stephen Breyer turned 78 on August 15th. Since 1960, 78 years old is the average age which a Supreme Court justice has left the bench. That means, as Nan said, there's a real likelihood that the next president, especially if he or she serves for two terms, will have two, three, maybe four seats to fill on the court. It will determine the outcome of literally every constitutional issue. Three issues were discussed last night concerning the Supreme Court. One was abortion, and it's where you saw the clearest difference between the candidates. Donald Trump was explicit that he would want justices who would overrule Roe versus Wade, that it would be left to each state, and he said it should be left to the states. What that would then mean is in slightly less than half the states, laws would immediately go into effect that are already on the books. They would prohibit all or almost all abortions, and it would be left to each state to decide for itself. Hillary Clinton said that she believes in Roe versus Wade, that she believes that a woman should be able to choose whether to terminate the pregnancy. There was a discussion that was confusing about the Supreme Court's decision with regard to partial birth abortion, and they were talking about abortions in the ninth month of pregnancy. Every state prohibits post-viability abortions, but the Supreme Court in Roe versus Wade said that there can be post-viability abortions only if it's necessary to protect a woman's life or health. The Federal Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act prohibits a specific form of abortion, both pre- and post-viability. And Hillary Clinton was saying she believes that that law should have been declared unconstitutional because she left to a woman and her physician. Donald Trump was saying that he thinks that ninth-month abortions are abhorrent, but I think it would be very hard for people who are listening to the debate to understand what that conversation was about. Bottom line, clear difference. Donald Trump wants justices who will overrule Roe versus Wade. Hillary Clinton wants justices who will continue Roe versus Wade. A second issue that was discussed concerns campaign finance and especially Citizens United. Hillary Clinton was clear that she wants to appoint justices who will overrule Citizens United. That, of course, is the 2010 decision that held that corporations can spend unlimited amounts of money from their treasuries in election campaigns. Donald Trump was less explicit about this, but it seemed clear he's not a critic of Citizens United and that the justices who he appoints aren't going to be ones who would vote to overrule Citizens United. In fact, his justices are very likely to strike down other federal, state, and local campaign finance laws. The third issue that was discussed concerns guns and the Second Amendment. And here, too, I think that the discussion during the debate was somewhat hard to follow. The case of District of Columbia versus Heller was raised. This was a 2008 Supreme Court case where the Supreme Court, 5-4, declared unconstitutional a D.C. ordinance that prohibited private ownership or possession of handguns. This is the first case in American history to ever declare unconstitutional any law, federal, state, or local, that regulates guns. Prior to District of Columbia versus Heller, the few Supreme Court cases of the Second Amendment always said that it means what it says. It's a right to have guns just for the sake of militia service. Justice Scalia, in the opinion, said that the Second Amendment also protects the right to people to have guns, at least in their home, for the sake of security. Donald Trump quoted a Hillary Clinton statement criticizing District of Columbia versus Heller. Hillary Clinton then said, well, what I was really criticizing was that the law was also there to protect children, that the law was to make sure that people had their guns safely locked up. That's not what the D.C. ordinance was about. It was an ordinance that prohibited private ownership and possession of handguns. But I think what you can infer from the debate is that Donald Trump was emphatic. He wants justices who will broadly interpret the right of individuals to have guns, building on District of Columbia versus Heller, striking down many laws that regulate firearms. Hillary Clinton is critical of District of Columbia versus Heller, and though she didn't go as far as she had earlier, it's clear she wants justices who will take a very different view of the Second Amendment, likely returning to the view that it's only about a right to have guns for militia service. Now, many other issues turn on this election, like the death penalty, affirmative action, separation of church and state. Those weren't discussed. Let me just say one final word. What was much discussed, and probably the largest takeaway from the debate, was Donald Trump's statement that he won't necessarily accept the result of the election. He'll wait and see and keep us all in suspense. I just want to emphasize here that the Constitution doesn't require that the losing candidate concede. If the Electoral College chooses Hillary Clinton, no matter what Donald Trump believes, Hillary Clinton is the next president of the United States. Now, Donald Trump could certainly bring a challenge with regard to the election, but there's no way to challenge it nationally. He would have to challenge state by state. And every state has its own law in terms of things like recounts. Usually the state law requires that there has to be a very close margin of difference in order to have a recount. We obviously saw that in Florida in 2000. If it is a close election, like in 2000, that depends on what happens in a few states, could easily imagine whoever is the loser bringing a challenge there. But if the election doesn't turn in that way in a few states in a close margin, then no matter what Donald Trump says in terms of his view of the outcome of the election, Hillary Clinton will be next president if she wins the Electoral College.
Thank you, Irwin. Now I'd love to turn to Jamal Green.
Thank you, Nan. I want to say just a word about Mr. Trump's hedge on accepting the election results, then a brief word on two of the substantive topics that came up, some of which were mentioned by Dean Chemerinsky. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that the greatest gift this country has given the world is the peaceful transfer of political power. If you look back historically, the 1800 election between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, it's one of the few that rivals this one in terms of the level of acrimony between the major party candidates. And yet the peaceful transition from the Adams to the Jefferson administration might have been the first time in the history of civilization that a political leader peacefully ceded control to his political opponent. We have a very strong, proud, and unblemished tradition in this country of candidates for the highest office accepting the election results. Now, obviously, there can be extraordinary circumstances when, after the election, the numbers are very close, and you want to ensure the accuracy of the count in some particular state or in some set of states, as in a recount scenario that we saw in the 2000 election. But to announce in advance that you're going to be suspicious of the results is a dangerous and unprecedented form of incitement. Now, Substantively, I think on the issues that were discussed at greatest length, abortion rights and gun rights, I think we largely saw party line thinking on those issues. So unsurprisingly, there was a bit more nuance from Secretary Clinton. On abortion, I think the most important thing for role for legal scholars here is to correct Mr. Trump's mischaracterization of the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act that that Secretary Clinton voted against when she was in the Senate. He seemed to suggest that the act targeted abortions of viable fetuses just before their birth. In fact, as Dean Chemerinsky noted, the act applied to non-viable fetuses as well, and in fact, the majority of abortions covered by this procedure involved non-viable second trimester fetuses, and the act did not provide an exception for situations in which the abortion was necessary to prevent a serious health problem for the pregnant woman, as the court's decisions in Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey require. It's the most tragic form of sensationalism to suggest that women who opt for this procedure are essentially killing children in the ninth month of pregnancy. As to the Second Amendment, the Supreme Court in the District of Columbia versus Heller case, which Justice Scalia wrote, said that the right to bear arms was an individual right, but that it was also subject to common sense regulation. Secretary Clinton agreed with that at the debate, so as far as that goes, in that sense, she did not disagree with the court's decision in Heller. What she disagreed with was the court's view in that particular case that the D.C. law struck down was actually unreasonable. And here I'm going to part ways slightly from Dean Chemerinsky and note that one of the parts of the law that the Supreme Court struck down in Heller mandated that rifles and shotguns either be unloaded or have trigger locks, and that was designed to prevent accidental shootings by children, which Secretary Clinton did refer to at the debate. As far as I can tell, Mr. Trump has not stated what he thinks would be a reasonable or common sense gun regulation, other than at a prior debate saying that denying guns to people on the terrorist watch list would be permissible. In general, I'm a bit surprised that the moderator did not ask about the Garland nomination, which has now been stalled for more than 200 days in the Senate. And I wish the candidates had been asked whether they believe that a sitting president should have only 3 years in which he or she gets to nominate Supreme Court justices, which appears to be the position of the Republican leadership in the Senate and would be a dramatic departure from American history.
So I'm wondering if we have any questions from members of the press. We're just trying to ascertain that now.
At this time, if you'd like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touch-tone phone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touch-tone phone. And we'll pause a moment to allow questions to queue. And we'll take a question from Richard Wolf with USA Today. Please go ahead.
Hey, thanks for doing the call, all of you. On what Trump had to say about Roe v. Wade, I'd appreciate you weighing in on what he means by automatically. It would happen automatically. It doesn't seem that anything would happen automatically, no matter who he puts on the court. So can you describe what you think he meant by it automatically goes back to the states?
If Roe versus Wade is overruled, then it would be left to each state to decide for itself whether or not to allow abortion, whether to prohibit all abortions, whether to allow some abortions, like in cases of rape or incest. What the law was, of course, before Roe versus Wade in 1973, was each state was able to decide for itself. In 1973, four states had legal abortions. About half the states prohibited all abortions. About half the states allowed abortions in cases of rape or incest. Obviously, nothing is automatic when it comes to the Supreme Court. There would have to be a case that would come to the court that would be the vehicle for the majority of the court to overrule Roe versus Wade. That's obviously likely to happen if there's a majority of justices willing to do it. And then when the court overrules Roe, it's left to each state. And it is worth noting in terms of the word automatically, there are a significant number of states, so less than half, as I mentioned, that have laws on the books right now that would prohibit all or almost all abortions. And in a number of states, their courts have ruled those laws would immediately go into effect if Roe versus Wade was overruled. So my guess is all of this goes into what's meant by automatically.
And all I would add to that is just an historical footnote, which is that in 1992, the Supreme Court decided Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania versus Casey. When that decision came down, it was anticipated at oral argument that because the court was a majority of pro-life justices, that Roe versus Wade was going to be overruled, and in fact, that was the original vote in the case until Justice Kennedy changed his mind. What the court in Casey said is what the justices in the majority said was that even if they were personally pro-life or personally thought that Roe versus Wade was incorrectly decided, the fact that it's a longstanding precedent that people have relied on over the years was also relevant to the decision. So not only is everything that Dean Chemerinsky said correct about there needing to be an actual case, but the fact that a judge is pro-life does not commit that judge to saying that Roe versus Wade needs to be overruled.
Thanks much.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, it is star and one on your touch-tone phone.
I'd like to ask a question at this juncture. Actually, two questions. One is, and Jamal Green touched on this briefly, but back to what was said last night at the debate, what would you have liked besides asking about the Garland nomination? What would you both have liked Chris Wallace to ask about the Supreme Court? Jamal, yeah. Do you want to start since you opened it up?
Yes, I think the most pressing question for me would have been again about the Garland nomination, not Garland himself necessarily, but the kind of precedent it establishes when the Senate decides that it's going to on its own render the court a court of eight justices rather than nine. The court's primary function in the modern era is to resolve disagreements among lower courts about the state of the law. And if you leave the court with an even number of justices, it really disables it in being able to do that. And we saw in the previous term a number of instances of the court punting on issues that it wanted to decide but could not decide. Because it had a limited number of justices. So it's really an institutional question about separation of powers and what the role of the Senate should be in confirming justices. I think substantively, there's a lot of attention paid to issues like abortion. Abortion rights are not really a presidential level issue in most instances. Abortion laws are passed for the most part, on a state-by-state basis. So some of the questions of executive power that are actually quite relevant to the president, for example, the President Obama's immigration directive, or questions of drone strikes, or those kinds of questions which actually do very much implicate the power of the executive office, I think would have been more pertinent questions to ask of presidential candidates.
I think I would have wanted to see him ask the basic question. Should a president have an ideological litmus test for Supreme Court nominees? And do you have an ideological litmus test? When you meet with prospective nominees, will you ask as to their views on specific issues and which issues? The only one takes a slight exception of a Green set is with regard to abortion rights and the importance for this election. I think if Donald Trump wins and the Republicans keep both houses of Congress, there will be a federal law adopted, very restrictive with regard to abortion. That issue is so central to conservatives. And I also believe that if Donald Trump wins and he gets to pick justice to the court, there will be a majority to overrule Roe versus Wade. I personally have no doubt that Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Thomas and Alito will vote to overrule Roe. And if they get two other justices, then I think Roe will be overruled. And it's always possible that some Republican, like a David Souter, even Anthony Kennedy, could come on the court and surprise us by not being the fifth vote. But I think the very experience with David Souter makes it much less likely that that's going to ever happen in the future. So I do think that those who care about abortion, this election is enormously important.
My other question is, Hillary Clinton last night emphasized that she wants a court and justices to protect the rights and liberties of all Americans, not just the wealthy and powerful. And I'm wondering, do you think she was hinting that the current court and the current composition of the court does not uphold the rights of everyone, but a select few? If both of you could give us your thoughts about the Roberts Court, and that would be really helpful.
Well, I'll just begin by naming just a few areas that she could have been referring to. One is the one that she made reference to at the debate, which is the Citizens United decision, which was, I think, startlingly dismissive of the state's interest in leveling the playing field when it comes to political campaign funding, and was solicitous of corporate interests. The court in that decision did not seem to take into account the fact that corporations are created by states and given particular advantages by states in order to maximize profit, and so they should not necessarily be treated the same way that individuals are treated when it comes to free speech rights. The other thing I'll mention, which is related, is that in a number of cases, the Supreme Court has used, the Roberts Court in particular, has used the First Amendment and free speech principles as a deregulatory tool, as a way of limiting the common sense regulation, for example, regulation of the practices of pharmaceutical companies in distributing lists of physicians, the efforts by the FDA and the Department of Agriculture to engage in health and safety regulation. There's been a conservative movement to use the First Amendment as a defense to say essentially that commercial entities and corporations are engaged in a form of speech when they market their products to people. The other thing I would mention, and this has really been a strong trend, I think, of the Roberts Court, is limiting what lawyers refer to as standing. That's the opportunity for individuals to get their cases heard before a court in the first place. And that's really a major vehicle for individuals to challenge powerful interests, either corporations or the government, is to be able to go into court and have a court treat the litigant with the same respect that it treats the powerful interests on the other side. And so limiting standing, limiting the ability of individual litigants to reach court is strongly protective of the interests of the powerful.
I agree with everything Professor Green just said. I think that what she was referring to is that the Roberts Court, more than anything else, has been a very pro-business court. In fact, a study was done by Richard Posner, the judge on the Seventh Circuit, William Landis, a professor at the University of Chicago, and Lee Epstein, a professor at Washington St. Louis, that documented that this is the most pro-business court that there's been since the mid-1930s. And in addition to the examples Professor Green mentioned, there are many others. There's the way in which the Supreme Court has aggressively enforced arbitration clauses inform contracts so that consumers, employees who are injured can never get their day in court just because of boilerplate language like on the back of an application or in a small print on a form. Of the way in which the Supreme Court has dramatically restricted class action suits. And while class actions don't have popularity, when people realize when a large number of people are injured and you suffer a small injury, it's really a class action or nothing. People can't go to court for a small amount of money. And if there's not class actions, then large corporations are wrongly tremendously infringed. The Supreme Court has made it much harder to sue pharmaceutical companies. In a couple of cases, Pleva versus Mensing and Mutual Pharmaceuticals Bartlett, the Supreme Court said that when people are injured by generic drugs, even horribly injured, they can't sue the generic drug companies, not for a design defect, not for a failure to warn. These are decisions that affect all of us, where the court has tremendously protected business from liability. And I think that's what she meant. What's interesting is her saying that was an answer to a question about how should the Constitution be interpreted. Should the court follow the language and original meaning? And Donald Trump said, yes, I want justices who will just follow the language and original meaning. Hillary Clinton didn't answer that part of the question. And I think she had the opportunity to say, of course it has to be a living Constitution. Article 2 of the Constitution refers to the president and vice president as he. The framers intended they'd be men. Does that mean it's unconstitutional to elect a woman as president or vice president until the Constitution is amended? The same Congress that ratified the 14th Amendment also voted to segregate the District of Columbia public schools. Does that mean that Brown versus Board of Education was wrongly decided? In order to protect all Americans, it has always been and has to be a living Constitution.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, it is star and one on your touch-tone phone. And we'll take a follow-up question from Richard Wolf with USA Today. Please go ahead.
Hey, thanks. I don't want to dominate this call, but I got one quick question on Garland. And that is, twice now, Secretary Clinton has had the opportunity to endorse his confirmation, at least under the current president. She has sort of done that without mentioning him by name. Curious that she doesn't mention him by name, but I'm wondering whether you all think that what she has said now twice about the Senate ought to act on Obama's nomination means in the Obama administration only and not even after January 20th.
I think she's understandably keeping her options open. I think that if Hillary Clinton is elected, there's a real chance that Senate Republicans will decide to confirm Merrick Garland in December. He'll be 64 years old then. By all accounts, he's moderate. And I could imagine Senate Republicans feeling better to take a 64 moderate than take the chance on a much younger liberal. I think if Hillary Clinton wins and the Republicans keep the Senate, there's a real chance that she will renominate Merrick Garland. He's not a controversial nominee. She could decide she doesn't want to use the political capital for a confirmation fight early in her presidency, and he's safe. On the other hand, if she wins and the Democrats take over the Senate, I could imagine her wanting the possibility of picking somebody who's younger and more liberal. And so I understand completely why at this point she's not going to commit to anything. Keep her options open.
Thanks much.
Any thoughts?
I agree with that. I don't think that she has committed herself either way, and I think she'll see how the Senate looks. She'll see how her margin of victory looks. And again, I hesitate to get far inside the internal thinking of the campaign, other than to say I think she's clearly keeping her options open. And I agree with Dean Chemerinsky that one of the factors that will weigh heavily is whether you want to spend political capital in the first several months of a new presidency fighting about the Supreme Court when you have a nominee that several Republicans have already said is eminently qualified, and you may well have additional appointments later in your term.
Well, unless there are any more questions, I think we'll wrap up this call. And our thanks and gratitude to Erwin and Jamal for a wonderfully interesting half-hour discussion about last night's debate and about the Supreme Court. The debate will be on our website, afjactioncampaign.org, at the call. The call will be on the afjactioncampaign.org, and thank you all for joining. What was a wonderful conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.